We are talking with Mr. and Mrs. Fritz Anderson of Stockholm. Mr. Anderson, will you tell us some of your family background?
My parents came from old Sweden in the year 1871, from different parts of Sweden. And his name was most commonly known to his death as Little Fred. And they came here as the father's a young man, and his, my mother. My father didn't have any parents, and he came with his brother. He got restless, moved away, and didn't stay there. But he journeyed to Fort Fairfield, and from Fort Fairfield he was recommended to Holton, where he went to a lawyer, Cyrus Powers, and did chores and went to school 4 years, so that he learned the English language. He didn't hear and see any Swedes. He had to learn. He learned the English language very well and could read and write. And then they pushed him a little fast, so he got his citizenship papers. So he was ready to vote when he was 21 years old or so. Anyway, he voted in the fall of 1876 for Rutherford B. Hayes. Then he drifted around the countryside and worked a little here and there, worked in the quarries in Monson. And my mother, at the age of 13, went to Portland, Maine. Whether she had got any schooling before that, I cannot say. It's possible she did a little. She went to Portland, Maine, and worked for this Latham family, a well-known Portland family, prominent Portland family, until she was around 20 years of age, when she married. And they met, my father drifted around, but they occasionally came up to visit their folks, and there they met up in this part of the country. Then they drifted back to work. And then when they decided to get married, they got married in Portland, Maine, and they spoke mostly the English language. Then his brother urged him to come back up here, take a farm. They were just moving, the farms were very well taken in Sweden, and they were just moving across the line into Stockholm. So my father took this lot, and with his bride they built a log cabin, which they later on added on. And to them, there were four children that grew up to manhood. And the speaker of this is the youngest of the tribe.
When were you born?
I was born in the year 1896. Mm-hmm. So I was just in line to be in the second contingent of the latter part of World War I.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us something about the Stockholm's first settlers?
And this consisted of the 14 families. They kept on moving in. The two very first families I want to mention is the Mr. and Mrs. Alfred Swenson and Mrs. Johannes Anderson. Now the other 14, other 12, I'm not going to mention, as it would take the time, but there were 14 families in all. That settled. 10 settled on the south, and 4 families settled on what is now 161, but it was called the Foot Camp Road. Mm-hmm. And on the top of this high hill, as you cross the Norwegian line, it's a very steep hill. And they call that, it's a little sounding better in Swedish than English, but in translating it correct, they call that the Sugar Heights, because some of the French people from up country used to come down and tap maple sugar there.
Oh.
So it's called the Sugar Heights. This is. And that took care of, that is the way that the settlement remained until the year 1890, which my book shows. Then in 1890, they started to make some kind of a homemade bridge across the river and settled on the north side of the town, which they nicknamed Uppsala, which is a suburb of Stockholm, Sweden. In
to some of us older people, we still refer to it as Uppsala. And then some 10, 11 odd families or so, some 30, 40, but they settled there. And that, of course, increased the population. Well, we must consider that these people had no way of marketing their goods anything nearer than Caribou, Maine.
Were they all farmers?
All farmers. They had to go to Caribou, Maine. When my parents lived, this was at the New Sweden town line. As near as they could, one of the nearest ones. But they still had over 15 miles to go to Caribou. And those who lived on the north side of the river had 2 miles more. And of course, then the pressure came. Schools. And Mr. Burley, Mr. Albert Burley, I should have mentioned him before, but Mr. Albert Burley was, of course, one of the main owners of this west side of the town. And whereas my father was the only one that could speak English and write and read English, of course, and he naturally became their spokesman, and of course, from where Mr. Burley turned to. So they worked together and became very fast friends. And they got together that what this town needed was an incorporation. So they gathered in my parents' home. Many of these people, of course, were not voters at the time. Especially those who came in the 1890s. They hadn't had time to get it. It was hard for them, the language barriers, but they got their citizenship papers a little simpler than I have to do today. But they organized. And then, with the aid of Mr. Burley, they got organized, and the bill was presented to the legislature, and Stockholm was incorporated as a plantation without any argument, with about 25 families living there. Then the pressure came to get some schooling. Most of these children were born in this country as they came. But as time went on, you know, these children had to get to school somewhere. So little substituting was done in New Sweden, but it was awkward, and they probably were filled anyway. We had to have a school. So a schoolhouse was built called the Berkeley School up on the South Hill where the first settlers came in the 1880s. And that was the only meeting place they had. So there they had some religious meetings and Christmas concerts and everything else. The beginning, that was the beginning of the life, because after that we were organized and they could hold town meetings. And the first town meetings were held in Swedish.
Ah. When?
But it had to be.
When was the town incorporated?
It was incorporated into a plantation in 1895, and in 1911 it's incorporated as a town.
Is that first school still standing?
That school is standing by in a way, but not in its place. It was sold for $50 and moved into New Sweden as a dwelling house. It's still standing, that very first school. Then the next school was built on the North Hill in 1903. And that burned out, I think, in 1939 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That became the schoolhouse for the children on the north side of the town, see, and also the village. So that brings us down to the railroad. I'm telling you about there was some controversy about where the railroad should go, but through Mr. Burley's influence, it was only natural that it would naturally go on from Caribou to Van Buren, because that was cleared land, and there was people already settled there, and they needed the railroad. But some of them could. But, of course, it was definitely established that the Van Buren would finally land in Van Buren. So the railroad, Mr. Burley went out, and this railroad was hooked up from Caribou, the Bangor and Aroostook Railway, hooked up from Caribou. And it touched one corner of the town of Woodland, and then it passed through New Sweden. They got to the northern end of Sweden, it passed right through the center of the town and into Stockholm. And it was started in 1898 and finished in 1899. Then we got a flag station. and we started to build potato houses. And then this 15 to 17 miles hauling that potatoes. My father hauled his produce for the first 15 years he was on the farm to Carrollwood, and they had 15 miles, but not too good team.
So the railroad must have made quite a difference.
The railroad was the lifeblood that started the thing going. It was just like fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
and then, with the advent of the railroad and the lumber interest up around the lakes and around and the surrounding, it became natural that a sawmill, with all the soft lumber there was, it was natural place to build a sawmill because the river was here, see. They had the water, so they built the dam. And Perry and Yerkesy built this bill in 1900. But that was sold out to Mr. Quimby and Mr. Trapp in 1901. It was sold out. And they started the Stockholm Lumber Company. No, pardon me, I'm mistaken there. I went ahead of it. It was sold out to Mr. Charles A. Milliken and Carl E. Milliken, former governor of Maine. The Millikens bought it. And then they built it. They called the Stockholm Lumber Company. And then they built this large store in 1902, the boarding house in 1902. This boarding house was in the process of construction. I even recall it in the year 1901, when they celebrated their first celebration, 20-year celebration. So that started the growth. So we had about 25 at that time, 25 farms there. Then, after the turn of the century, we expanded out what was now known as School Street. And I don't know, State gives me time to explain what California is.
But yes, we'd like to know about California.
Well, I tell you how California. There was an act in the legislature some years back that were given these towns 1,000 acres of land. The landowners had to relinquish 1,000 acres of land for each town. And when these lands were 500 acres in Stockholm, within the east side and the west side. Well, on the east side, they were settled into six farms. And one of the men that settled up in this California settlement, there were six farms tied up. Lived in California, so he started to call it California, and California to this day. But there's no people living there now. They cleared the land there on at least five of the farms,
mm-hmm.
One of them. And then this was 4 miles away from town, so when these families moved in there, the children had to be transported out to Stockholm. So that was their little growth, and this happened around just a little before World War I, when this was measured up and started out, somewhat before World War I.
So the railroads and the mills really were the two big things that contributed to the growth of Stockholm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in 1904, they built this big veneer mill, a five-story building. And people rushed here, and houses were built. The houses sprang up and people moved in here and the population started to grow.
Who owned that mill?
That mill was owned by Quimby and Trapp. Alan Quimby and Trapp.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Trapp and sold out his share and it was called the Alan Quimby Company. And then it was later changed to Standard Veneer Company. And they, in turn, in 1925, sold it to the Atlas Plywood Corporation.
And wasn't it, under the Atlas, wasn't it the largest mill in the state?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was considered the largest. It's at one time, it was the largest thing in the world, but they seem to cut it down to the state lately.
Mm-hmm.
But it burnt down in 19. This five-story building burnt down in 1912.
Was it ever rebuilt?
And it was rebuilt in a more modern way. So many of the things that were there, but it still required a lot of people to work there.
But how many did they employ? Do you remember?
Well, at a little later date, they built another building across the street. They even had a sort of a covered bridge across the street for a time that went over. That how many people were involved there is somewhat a little hard to say. But we believe that at its peak there were probably 250 men working. We believe that.
And a lot of them came from outside and moved in to Stockholm to work in the mills.
Well, a number at the turn of the century, quite a few Swedes came over and worked in the mills. Mm-hmm. Some of them later bought farms. And then a few French families came in here, and a few English-speaking families worked in the mills too. But the French families gradually came in until 1917. Then the real influx came, because the big expansion of this mill across the road that I talked about, mm-hmm. the covered bridge, that was called the Standard Box Company. And in 1922, in the fall of 1922 and the 23, they tried to manufacture close to there, which they operated for a few months, mm-hmm. and that was all.
Mm-hmm. You say tried to, it didn't work out?
Well, it didn't seem to be profitable. Mm-hmm. So they were close to stop. But it still, the space was still converted into other things. So that the number of people in the population slightly grew. In 1919, you know, we found the need, the difficulty of traveling for high school education, of course, had to be done in Caribou, no other way. So in 1919, we started a two-year high school with a few scholars. And that kept on until it was about, it says here that it was closed up in 1961, for 2 years. But it was held on with a ninth grade for a few, two, three more years. That's the end of it. Due to, it was difficult to get teachers. The State Department of Education didn't deem it large enough to maintain a high school, so we had to give up. But it had over a 40-year life, mm-hmm. which was a great asset to the town. It was many people received their high school education due to the fact that they could get 2 years here, and then they could live out the other 2 years in Caribou. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't get to Caribou, they had at least 2 years anyway.
Mm-hmm. When did the big mill close?
The big new modern mill, closed its doors January 15, 1932. And if I hadn't been so involved in town affairs, I wouldn't remember, because as I wrote in the book, I said it was Stockholm's darkest day. Mm-hmm.
This was right in the midst of the Depression.
Just as the Depression was. We didn't feel the Depression seriously in the town of Stockholm until that day.
Until that day. Why did the mill close, do you know?
The mill closed, of course. You know, there was very little market for hardly anything during the Depression, no matter what the goods were. And as we look into it, we saw that the hardwood lumber was diminishing in this area. That is a question of how many more years they could have continued Depression or no Depression. Thinking it over, some of the old timers, we commenced to realize that. We realized some of it before it happened too. But of course the Depression speeded it up. Mm-hmm. So it closed up because the Atlas people, they reduced their mills in other places also.
Can you tell us something about the Depression years in Stockholm?
Depression years in Stockholm is a sad one. When 150 men walks out in a poor town with the only people here that were earning anything was a few railroad men, and the farmers were getting nowhere near cost of production for their potatoes. But somehow or another we hung on. We started woods projects, different woods projects. The men got paid very, very little because they had the goods. To sell the goods we couldn't get much income, but we had woods projects and to keep them alive. And we kept them alive with wood projects, and then we started to appeal to Augusta. I made several trips to Augusta. One of my first trips to Augusta was in the year 1933. And then I got a small project called the CWA. So it was just like applying a few plasters on your wounds here and there. And then a little later on, emergency aid came up. And then the WPA. And then the town went broke in the meantime, to Anna. So I ended my career as a selectman from the year 1927 to 1939. I said, I've seen you over the worst. Now I want to rest.
Well, 12 years through those bad years, that was really a hard time to be selectman.
Hadn't I had good health and been reasonably young, I could have never lived through it. Mm-hmm. And my wife suffered with it.
Well, yes, I'm sure she must have. The town at that time was a town manager form of government.
No, absolutely selected.
Ah, town manager came later.
The town manager came at the reorganization in 1944.
Ah, I see.
See, when it went back on its own. After the state took over in 1939, later, or 40. Then the state took over and administered like they did with a number of towns here, Brewster County.
So as first selectman, then you really did bear the brunt of it.
I did bear the brunt of it. I had two men with me. But, of course, the first selectman did, well, it depended on who I had with me.
But most of the responsibility was yours.
The responsibility was mine to a large extent. In this wood party, it depended a lot on who I had with me. Mm-hmm. But as far as the bookkeeping concerned, and the keeping, that was totally left to the first selectman.
You had town meetings.
We had town meetings every year, and the officers were elected for 1 year with the exception of the school board. The school board was elected for a term of 3 years. And we had the town meetings, and we had, they were so interesting that people came from outside towns to hear our orators. Some of them talked in broken French, and some of them talked in broken Swedish. And most of them directed it towards me. I got used to that. And I was, as I said before, I'd like to use even a rougher name, but we call it heckling. And heckling I got. But I lived through it. And I slept when I come home to work.
These town meetings were day-long affairs.
What?
Usually the town meetings were day-long.
Day-long?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The different societies furnished the dinner, and we paid for it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generally open at 10 o'clock in the morning and closed anywhere from 3 to half past 4 in the afternoon.
Did people come and bring their children?
No, not as a rule, except that very often the freshmen and the sophomore grades in the high school were given a little vacation to sit in on the town meetings. I can recall that so many times. that they, and perhaps even the 7th and 8th grades, I can't say for sure, but especially they were left in on the higher school group, and they were taking notes.
Well, during
as
these
part
years,
of the schoolwork.
Yes, I think classes do that today. During these years at Stockholm was at its peak. Was there a police department?
Not exactly. We hired for 2 years, somewhat, in the 1920s. We had two different years. And we had a policeman, only it's 2 years. But we had a jail. That we had a cell,
mm-hmm.
rather.
And where was that?
That was underneath the Eureka Club building.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a cell there that we could lock the person up. And we had a policeman here, and he was tax collector in with it for 2 years. He got a salary of $1,200. That was...
Did you ever have many in the cell?
Now and then.
Just now and then.
I served as constable for some years, also when we had the regular police. I served constant for some years.
What might their offenses have been?
Might the offenses have been?
Mm.
Varied.
Oh? Nothing too serious?
When we had a celebration, 45th celebration, we locked up one man just to quiet him down, and when night came, we opened the door and let him out.
Let him go.
And one man was locked up for shooting a deer in close time.
But there was never anything really very serious?
No. We locked up one man for beating up another fellow.
Mm. Did Stockholm have a fire department?
The real fire department has come of late.
Ah.
We had a chief. We started back around 1921 or 22, we bought a Ford Model T truck that we used soda and gas, acid rather, and water, mixed it together, that we used. And in 1930, that pretty well wore out. By 1932, we bought a Chevrolet and mounted the same material on there. And we had a chief, and chief usually appointed a few people to help him, and it wasn't really, but later on it became more organized. Today we have a fully organized
volunteer.
We have three different vehicles today,
mm-hmm.
and pumpers that can be put into the water supplies and pump the acid and the soda. That's gone now.
Did Stockholm ever have any bad fires?
None of any real extremes, except that large mill.
Mm-hmm. How did that one start, do you know?
No, I have no knowledge of
it. But it was completely burned?
Yes, it was completely burned. Once it got loose, there was nothing could stop it.
Mm-hmm. Well, those mills being right beside the river, were there ever any floods?
In the spring of 1923, we had, as usual, a deep snow that Rooster County is famous for, and it hung on until late in April. And all of a sudden, the thermometer went up 60, 65, 70, and the first thing you knew, we had 80.
Mm. In April?
In April, the latter part of April. And everything broke loose. And we pictured to show where we had this old wooden bridge. See, when they first settled here, they made a little bridge, almost anything, logs to walk over for people on the other side. But then they built a wooden bridge that we drove automobiles and horses and everything over. And that stood there till 1923. And that bridge went right under the water, went right under it, went right over it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go over the railing, but it went over the floor.
Didn't wash the bridge out?
No, so it
that stood.
It stood the test. And, but then Then the state of Maine, though, has stepped in, and in the fall, called 1923, built the present bridge that is there today.
Well, now, when you first, when you were younger, you didn't have electric lights.
There was electric light supplied by the mills for mostly their higher class employees. And some, and the store I worked in didn't have the benefit of. We had a public, we had a private system. But they run something there, that they, a dynamo from the mill. But then, and some others got some benefit out of it, but through disagreements, time doesn't give me space to explain, they cut them out. Then we got together and got in hold of Maine Public Service, and we organized a company. And these companies were organized, Kolbeck, Stach, Leidenpark, Woodland, New Sweden, Leidenpark Company, New Sweden, Stockholm, Leidenpark, and so on. So we organized a Leidenpark Company in Stockholm.
When was that?
In 1920, in the fall of 1922. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 1922. And by fall we had lights.
Yeah. But just the village part, how far out did it extend?
It extended out into the farming country, to those farmers that was willing to put in $200 apiece. As a share of stock.
That must have made quite a difference to the farmers to have electricity.
Yeah, but some of them didn't seem to be able to afford to do that well.
No.
So they didn't all get it. And we functioned until May 1927. Then we were they had a chance to sell. And of course we sold. And we had to take a loss on our shares, but we were glad to sell. Well, I have before me here a picture of a two-story building that was just about the same spot as the Catholic rectory stands now. And on the south, going up the steep Lynn Hill, and it's called the Lynn Hill Schoolhouse. It was built in 1905, and we thought it was pretty modern because it had two stories. And that was the third building, that a school building erected in Stockholm, which reflected the growth, the growth of the town. As the fourth state, that the veneer mill was erected in 1904, that meant that we built the building in 1905. It kind of shows that the population moved. Mm-hmm. And called for more schoolroom. Mm-hmm. So this was erected, and unfortunately it burnt in 1914. And then, as I have before me, we have this more modern four-room school building that is still stands over on School Street, on another downtown, on a more level, better grounds, better playgrounds. And then, as the population grew, as previously stated, we thought the town had reached its peak in population around 1925. But during that time, we had lost that number two school. So then we built a two-room schoolhouse in 1927 that we had the lower grades. And that is still standing today. But it's not used as a schoolroom, only as a library and storage and such things. And that is just about the size of it with the schools. We talked to you a little while ago about the summer sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we used to have summer sessions and winter sessions, and we come to the conclusion that one of those reasons was we had a shorter school year, and transportation would have had to been by heat team, absolutely. And most of us had to walk far, or at least the large part of them had to walk far. So I think that's one of the reasons for having summer sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But come round to the point, 1907 was the last summer session held in the town of Stockholm.
Mm-hmm.
From there on, our schools were graded. They'd already graded in this school here in 1905. But then we went into strictly graded schools and worked more on a consolidated basis.
Mm-hmm. When you were in school, was there ever any great discipline problem?
It varied so much with the teachers. We had one lady that had a very hard time. She taught three terms. Some of us behaved fairly well and some of them didn't. We had a lady come over from Hartland, New Brunswick. I think that was the first lady that I went to school for. And she had, she was quite cold and she had very good discipline. But some of those lady teachers up in the Berkeley School, let's call it, was a little slack. But as I have mentioned in my book about this Herman Henry, he was an able man, and what he lacked in formal education, his experience, was made him a great teacher. And there was no question about discipline there. Discipline was at 100% value. And I mentioned about Mrs. Merrill. Mrs. Merrill was one of my teachers, and she later meant a lot to my life, which I won't take time to explain. She had very good discipline. And after I left, Herman Henry left, and we finished up the ninth grade, we had varied teachers that winter, different ones. And some went to this and that.
Was it hard to keep a teacher?
No, as a rule, not. And things have changed. Now we'll go back to, we'll say, around the year 1919, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. We had mostly single girls coming from out of town. And then we had like Mrs. Wilson, we called her, and once in a while somebody that had gotten off to high school and had some local teachers. But we had, well, most of them were imported from Easton, Fairfield, and places like that. And I think this is due to the fact that it was so difficult for the children to get any higher education. That's why we lacked the teachers. Now, in later years, they've developed their own teachers. So we have, and most of these girls were single.
Because in those days, married women didn't teach. In many communities, they weren't allowed to teach. Were they allowed to here?
Yes, we accepted them whenever it was whenever it was plausible. But in the rule, we had imported teachers, and at this Merrill House, the hotel was usually the place where they stayed.
Do you have any idea, do you remember what they might have been paid?
Well, there's no place I could answer that as well as First Select Men, but that was only 12 years out of the whole town's history.
Well, that would be a good example.
Well, they were cut down to, they were paid, the very lowest they were paid was down to $14 a week at that time, during the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And sometime before that, the 30s, I was quite closely connected to town affairs even then. They were getting up in the 20s, the elementary teachers, and the high school teachers, one summer was as high as 47. But the school board got the haggling that time, mm-hmm. instead of me, because they had paid him too much.
47 was considered too much?
Yes, much too much. And this went down. But this seems to be the bottom. Mm-hmm. And as a child, or as a boy going in the 8th and 9th grade or in the other school, it would be hardly any use for me to make any guess what the teachers really got. But I dare say that at that time, most of them got about $12 a week. And I think that Mr. Henry, when I was in the eighth grade, in the year 1978, got $15 a week and he did the janitor work to go with it.
Now, the teaching in the schools was in English, and many of the families, when they came to Stockholm, spoke only Swedish. Now, was there any problem within the families between the Swedish-speaking parents and the children who were learning to speak English?
Very little. The problem was greater with the French, which perhaps isn't good for me to say, but the fact remained to be true. Due to the fact that the Swedish people made a greater effort to learn the English language themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think that there was very much controversy.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much recollection do you have of any kind of generation gap, of a cultural kind of generation?
Across the road from where I was brought up was one thing. There, they spoke Swedish in the home exclusively, although the mister picked up some little odds and ends of English. But there they had a fashion that you got these Swedish papers, and they had these continued stories. And this, then, a gentleman would sit at the table and all the girls will just sit around and have to sit and listen to this Swedish papers when he read this story almost every week. This did not happen in my home because we didn't have Swedish papers. We had all English papers. And I don't think this happened in everywhere. But the children going back to, we'll say, my recollections from 1905 to 1912, pretty well ended up my school year. In the Swedish families, the Swedish was very much spoken in the family. But later that was changed very much.
The children didn't try to keep up the Swedish.
Not much, and as yet it is peculiar. I can tell you something on that too, that it comes in areas. In the town of New Sweden, down around the Bangor and Rustic railroad station, that area of New Sweden, the people that are in their 40s today, and we'll say, can speak Swedish like very fluently, while other parts of New Sweden they can't speak English, Swedish hardly at all. Now, I can't explain it any more than that it's due to, I think, that many of those families had arrived from Sweden after the turn of the century, so that made quite a lot of difference than the ones that came 30 years before, or 25 years before, or even 20 years before.
The process of Americanization started all over again.
Yes, but these late comer Swedes, of course, was natural. I think that is one of the reasons why so many of the young people in around that area can speak Swedish so fluently. Well, other parts.
Are they more predominantly Lutheran in that corner than some of the other areas? Because the Lutheran churches kept up the Swedish language within the church and Sunday school longer than the other.
I wouldn't say that of the area around the Sweden station, because the area around the Sweden station is pretty much divided between the Lutheran and the Baptist.
Mm-hmm. So there are the reasons.
And the western side of the Westmoreland, the western side of the town in the center of Sweden, has quite a gathering in the Covenant. together with a mixture of the others. The Covenant had their head, had their headquarters on the west side.
I'd like to dig into that question, though, a little farther.